It is Thursday, August 19th, 2010, and we are talking to Mr. Richard Levy, who works for Wells Fargo. Mr. Levy, thank you for taking the time to talk to us today. My name is Chris Seifer, and with me are Cassidy Waskowitz, Gordon Shemin, and Scott Gans. We are all with the FCIC, created by a statute last year called the Fraud Enforcement and Recovery Act that tells us to figure out the various causes of the financial crisis and prepare a report by December 15th of this year. That statute tells us to look at a bunch of things, including the issue of systemically important institutions. That's why we have been looking at Wachovia in particular and the initial approval of an assisted deal by Citi and the subsequent unassisted deal by Wells Fargo. So thank you for taking the time to talk to us. Before we get into the substance, can you just summarize quickly your educational and work background, starting with college, please?
Sure. Good morning. I am a undergraduate of the Pennsylvania State University, Penn State, in accounting. I then received my master's in tax at Pace University. I'm a CPA. Work-wise, I have been the controller for Wells Fargo for 8 years. Prior to that, I was the controller at New York Life for 5 years. Prior to that, I was a partner at Coopers & Lybrand. Prior to that, I was senior VP in charge of tax and accounting at a bank called Atlantic Corporation, which is now part of PNC Financial. And prior to that, my beginning career, I started with the accounting firm of what is now Deloitte & Touche. It was actually Haskins & Sells back then.
I remember that. Thank you. Okay, so you've been a Wells controller since, I guess, 2002?
Correct.
Okay. All right. Okay, so let's first generally describe for us your involvement in the Wachovia acquisition.
Sure. I was involved along with the executive management throughout the due diligence weekend. That was a rather compressed time frame where we worked very diligently to try to get our arms around making a bid for the acquisition of Wachovia Corporation. And that was compressed over the weekend. I guess that was the 27th, 28th.
That would be Saturday and Sunday.
That Saturday and Sunday. And actually, I think I got a call late Friday, but we were ginned up. It actually came in shortly after, I think it was the weekend after the Washington Mutual kind of same fire drill where the WaMu was awarded to JPMorgan Chase. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of activity going on. I was at corporate headquarters on the executive floor and or in my office, which is just catty-corner to the building. Our buildings are somewhat dispersed. So the primary points of input that I was involved in were the purchase accounting, the actual accounting, working with the merger and acquisition team on accounting issues and how they would be dealt with, as well as coordinating with our tax team, which also reports to me, the tax consequences surrounding doing a deal. And the tax consequences are pretty significant because for a bank, especially a bank with losses that are not yet reflected for tax purposes but are being recognized for book purposes, it becomes an important issue in terms of those attributes. And Wachovia did have significant attribute on the tax side.
So just so I'm not a tax guy and not an accountant, but is so when a bank like Wachovia, for example, recognizes billions of dollars of loan loss provisions, that's not an expense for tax purposes?
There's a fundamental difference, and I'll stay at the large bank level. For accounting purposes, Banks are supposed to reserve and build a reserve for the losses inherent in the portfolio. For tax purposes, losses are recognized when the event of charge-off occurs. And there's a timing difference because you'll reserve for book purposes sooner than you will charge the loan off. All right, so it's,
right.
It's a little bit more of a significant delay between that recognition event of an expense, of a bad debt expense.
Right. I understand that. Okay, so go ahead, continue.
Well, that in essence would have been my role, working with management and the evaluation team to make sure that our models were accurate and any and all kind of accounting or tax issues that were being raised were being promptly addressed. Because again, purchase accounting is what you need to do in a transaction. In an acquisition, purchase accounting requires you to fair value all of the assets and liabilities being acquired. And so there's really kind of very complex rules that are going on. So you're really going into a very complex area. You've got complex accounting rules and very complex tax rules. And they obviously are not all in sync. And we want to make sure that as we move forward, we're understanding any consequence and we don't fall into any trap, so to speak, or find ourselves in a situation where we have an unexpected outcome. So again, kind of a technical area, making sure that we avoid any of those landmines.
So, mm-hmm. So we know from other interviews and documents that at the end of this compressed weekend, Wells decided that they could not make an offer that did not include some type of government assistance. Explain to me your role, if any, in Wells coming to that determination and why that was.
I didn't have a very big role in that determination because that was a credit determination. But I did have a seat at the table as the discussion was going on. And the discussion really centered around our inability to gain a comfort level at that point in time with primarily the commercial real estate components of the Wachovia portfolio. We had been spending a lot of time with the due diligence on all of the credit portfolios. And we were getting comfortable with the other kind of problematic portfolio, which is known as the pick-a-pay, which is the negative amortizing option ARM portfolio that Wachovia had acquired in their purchase of Golden West. But it was really the remaining portfolio that we were having dialogue with Wachovia on and even the regulators on in terms of trying to get our arms around that. And just due to time running out, quite frankly, and not having the ability to really complete that assessment, and not having the willingness to take the risk, time was not our friend in coming to a conclusion, because the regulators were very much signaling that they wanted to have some transaction consummated before the opening of the market on Monday.
Right. So time ran out in terms of getting your arms around the commercial real estate, but you were comfortable enough with the other stuff, the pick-a-pay and the other assets?
Well, I would say that's a high-level characterization. I can't say that there was the supreme confidence in everything else, but those were the problematic portfolios, the commercial and commercial real estate portfolios,
okay.
In terms of having a desire to continue to do credit analysis.
Okay. So we then know that on October 2nd that Mr. Kovacevic contacts the company and says, now we can do a deal. And we know from documents and interviews that apparently this IRS notice 2008-83 was part of the reason why. So explain to us what you know in that regard, just generally on why the unassisted offer comes in on October 2nd, what the reasons were, and including the tax reasons.
Sure, absolutely. So as we were going through the evening of the that Sunday evening, we obviously didn't know what the economics or terms of assistance would be. And we also, though, in an assisted transaction, all tax attributes are eliminated. Okay, so any of the benefits associated with tax attributes that would be that Wachovia was entitled to would get eliminated, and the level of assistance actually wasn't known until, quite frankly, the city deal was announced. And we had some back and forth with the regulators in terms of. Or the FDIC in terms of first loss sharing. So, you know, they were doing a dialogue with, obviously, us and it would appear more with city since they awarded it to city. What happened...
Can I stop you for a minute?
Certainly.
Just because I don't want to get too far lost. When you say that all of the tax attribute benefits would be eliminated in an assisted deal... Is my understanding correct then for what we were talking about before? The loan loss provisions, when they become charge-offs, then you wouldn't be able to take those as deductions from taxable income in an assisted deal, but you would in an unassisted deal?
That's correct. That's correct. That's by operation of an existing code section.
Okay.
It's 597. But I'm
of course.
A former tax guy, so... I'll qualify that, but I'm pretty sure it's 597. So any assisted government transaction, you know, it eliminates all tax attributes. Otherwise, tax attributes are, you know, are available if Wachovia was to remain independent. If Wachovia is acquired, those attributes get carry over. But then there are various other statute provisions that that kick into place, one of which is Section 382, which tries to limit any built-in loss or NOL carry forward to the extent that that recognition doesn't fall within its rules.
Okay, so go ahead and continue. I know from some of the documents we've seen, this whole IRS notice 2008-83 has a relationship with the Section 382 you just mentioned. And mm-hmm. Please realize that we are not tax folks here, and we definitely need the low-level remedial explanation.
I will try. Please stop me if you have questions, because this is not straightforward. Okay. So what the notice did was it actually was very helpful in prompting us to refocus back on a unassisted deal. And the fact that in an assisted deal you wouldn't have these attributes, and in an unassisted deal you would. But I will tell you that the amount of the benefit is not significant. Let me just cut to the chase, right? The reality is that the economics of the federal assistance as limited by first loss and loss sharing, and by this time now, a continuation of our credit analysis and what we thought the exposure was, versus the economics of losing carry forward attributes that Wachovia was entitled to but for the government assistance, was really the analysis that we put into place and in motion subsequent to the announcement by Citi. And I think we really did a very crash analysis, continuing really in the days Monday, Tuesday, to look through credit, but really swinging into high gear in tandem with that. It was on Tuesday, the 30th, as I recall, that the notice was provided. And it really did provide us with that refocus, if you will, on unassisted, assisted, tax attributes versus assistance. Is that helpful? Or any other questions?
It's helpful, and I want you to explain, you know, the amount of the benefit not being significant and everything else so we can understand it. But before you do that, help me understand why this notice coming out on the 30th has Wells refocus on the difference in tax treatment, whether it's an assisted or unassisted deal. Wasn't that just an obvious focus from the get-go? I mean, since that I don't get. Explain that to me.
Yeah, okay. One could say yes. There's an obvious difference, and that's where there's a significance. The assistance versus no assistance, but carryover tax attributes, right? That's where really the assistance is. The significance is. The significance between the operation of Section 382 with and without the notice is what I am saying was not very significant. So let me just clarify that point.
Okay.
So here we are. We have gone through a weekend, very compressed, very hectic. We're working without sleep. And we get informed very early in the morning of Monday that the target, Wachovia, had gone to city with their assistance. With a federal system.
Mm-hmm.
So really, by the time of Monday, everybody basically is tired, unshaven, and ready for a little bit of sleep. And we, in essence, re-caucus on Tuesday. And we're talking logically about where are we? And what else have we learned as we've continued to look at the information that we had and continue to analyze, one being taxes. So with or without the notice, we probably would have gotten there. It just really did help frame, hey, given now what we know about the federal assistance versus what we've been analyzing over the weekend in terms of an unassisted deal, it is clearly in our benefit to do an unassisted deal, because the economics are just better for Wells Fargo, and quite frankly, for the government from the FDIC perspective, no assistance, and for the shareholders, because can we make a compelling offer? And by the way, for Wachovia, because the assisted deal was only at the bank level, so there were a lot of pieces that would not be covered by that assistance that would have just gone, you've probably gone, I'm speculating, but probably gone south.
Mm-hmm.
Because they were untenable from a financing funding perspective. The holding company, their brokerage business, I mean, I don't know. That's crystal ball.
Mm-hmm. So are you saying that even if 2008-83 was never issued, that you think that at some point on Tuesday the 30th or a day after or whatever, you guys would have said, come to the conclusion that, hey, you know, now that we've had more time to look at this, we can make an unassisted bid, and in fact an unassisted bid is better for us than an assisted bid because of the tax loss carry forwards we're going to be able to utilize.
You know, it's, again, it's speculative. I actually think that the 08-83 notice really helped us say, geez, let's relook at this. So the logic would have been there to do it without the notice, but it sure helped us kind of train our focus back on, hey, let's look at these taxes, really deep dive now.
Well, let me ask it a different way. I mean, mm-hmm. putting aside, is the deal, would Wells, let me start again. The conclusion that an unassisted deal made more sense for Wells than an assisted deal because of the tax treatment, would that have been the case absent the issuance of 2008-83? And I don't mean just would that have triggered you to think about it. I just mean the actual quantification of the benefits.
Yes, because because the benefit of the notice really is a marginal timing difference. It's really a certainty as to when you would be able to take those attributes if they were to emerge. It's not about the absolute amount. The absolute amount, irrespective of the notice of the tax attribute related consequences, would be compelling irrespective of the notice. Yes.
Okay, so explain to me, or to us, the difference, if you can, in quantification of the benefit with or without 2008-83. And actually, if you can, give me the quantify the benefit period, and then how it would have been different if 2008-83 didn't come out.
Okay, maybe tough to fully do that. Let me just say that the benefit, the tax benefit of these attributes really is an ongoing process, because as we discussed earlier, the loans involved, because that's the primary differential between carryover of attributes or not, the loans that had lost content are still being managed and worked on by us now, and it's been over 18 months, not all of which have had charge-offs. So, you know, you're really talking about when do these tax attributes emerge? In this case, a bad debt deduction. So I think that the best way I can frame it would be that Section 382 kind of puts a limit on the annual amount of loss carry forward, or what they refer to in the tax code as built-in losses, that can be absorbed in a carry forward period. And so the essence of the ruling helped what I would call administratively lift some of the burden associated with 382, just stop me if I go too deep or too long, but what Section 382 of the code does is it says you have to look at your target and you have to compare what you're paying and what you're assuming from a liability perspective to the assets. Okay? Mm-hmm. And I think we might have sent you a spreadsheet in the volume of data. But in essence, you take that market value of what you pay, you take the liabilities, add that are recognized for tax, and you compare the sum of that, that's the consideration, to the tax basis of the assets. And if what you're paying is greater than the tax basis of the assets, you have what's called a built-in gain, and there's no limitation on the annual amount of benefit that you can get. If what you pay and is less than the assets tax basis, then you're in essence buying future deductions that, I guess, Congress, when they passed 382, which is very old law, said, hey, we want that to be limited because we don't want people trafficking and buying tax attributes. My theory. Mm-hmm. But anyway, that's the law. So why it's difficult to quantify is to say, well, it's a dynamic process. It all is going to be a function of all these attributes, the liabilities and the assets, and the consideration paid.
Right. So let me stop you so that I don't get too lost, because I think I understood the first part, but maybe not the second part. So it sounds like, you know, before we get to this price plus liabilities in the consideration versus the tax basis of the asset. That's where I got lost, so we'll come back to that in a minute. But in terms of the actual, you know, loan losses, or, you know, you can't take them until the loan is actually charged off. Are you saying that Section 382 essentially puts a limit on the amount of those losses that can be, you know, used to reduce taxable income each year?
Yes, in certain circumstances, and no, in other circumstances, and that's the dynamics that I'm talking about. So it's a maybe, right? Depends on your facts and circumstances. And so at a higher price, you would have no limit because you don't have a building loss. You have a building gain. At a lower price, you may trigger a building loss. And as we disclosed in our S-4, in fact, based on the final consideration that we struck the definitive agreement at, we had a $3 billion built-in loss. $3 billion, that's the deduction. Tax-affected, that's roughly $1 billion of tax, of cash. So we had, going in, a $3 billion new bill, it's called.
Right.
Net unrealized build-in loss. And using the required computation under the Internal Revenue Code, that would have been limited to, would have been required to be limited to 3 years. So you could only take $1 billion of that deduction, or again, 35% of that as cash benefit per year.
Okay.
What the notice really did was say, look, this built-in loss that you had, the $3 billion of deductions, that's, you have to actually track that each year, how much in the way of the assets were sold at a gain, how much is lost, what's the net result in that year. If that net result was over a billion, since it's $1 billion per year, then you're limited for the next $2 billion of loss in year one. And then any loss above that would not be limited in terms of attribute loss. Am I losing you again?
I think you're losing me a little, because on the one hand, I thought you said you're still going to be limited to taking a $1 billion write-off against taxable income, but then I thought you said something else after that.
So it's, think of it as like, what's a good analogy? It's almost like a donut hole. I don't know how to best describe it. You get to eat the whole donut, but not the hole in the middle. The hole in the middle is the amount of limitation. All right? And that will be limited, but allowed to be recognized over time. In our case, 3 years. So the hole, you can take a third of it in the first year, two-thirds in the second year, and the whole thing by the third year.
Is this right? I mean, that $3 billion new bill that you have when you close the deal, you can't, tell me if this is right, you can't take more than $1 billion the first year, you can't take more than a total of $2 billion over 2 years and a total of $3 billion over 3 years, but for example, you could take $500 million year one and $1.5 billion year two.
Correct.
Okay, and
let's say there was $5 billion of deduction, mm-hmm. All right, in year one, you would only be allowed, you take the first billion. Actually, let me use six. The numbers are better. It's $6 billion. You could take the first billion because it was allowed. The second, the hole, what I call the donut hole, from $1 billion to $3 billion. That $2 billion that was needs to be delayed. Mm-hmm. You would not get, and now you're at $3 billion. Then the remaining $3 billion you can get because it wasn't limited. So that's why, again, this is very complicated. Did you follow that?
I followed it, but sadly, it was not consistent with what I thought you said before. I didn't know you did. So when I said if you had 500 mil in the first year, you could take 1.5 in the second, that seems inconsistent with what you just said. Sounds to me like you said you would just automatically lose that 500 million you didn't take in the first year.
Okay. You will know. You will never lose the 500 unless your carry forward period runs out. So anything that's hung up because of 382 gets carried forward. So in your example, see, our examples were different. You used $1.5 billion. So in year one, that $500 million would not be recognized, but would be carried forward to year two, and would be recognized in year two.
Mm-hmm. I follow that.
In my example, I said, hey, there were attributes that were related to the Wachovia loan portfolio that were $6 billion.
Right.
So in that instance, I actually have, a different fact pattern where $1 billion gets recognized. I now carry forward $2 billion, not recognizing it in year one. And I could take $1 billion of that in year two and $1 billion of that in year three. And I, again, in my example, $3 billion were not subject to limit, can take that. And again, these are all hypothetical discussions,
right,
both your example and mine. So I don't think it's inconsistent. It's really how much loss due to bad debt charge-offs, because that's the primary driver here, would be recognizable in your tax return is the real key thrust.
Right.
And it's all fact-based because, well, how much of those losses emerged? In your example, at my example, we had two different original amounts of losses, and therefore application of the tax law would be different because your facts are different.
All right, this is Scott. I'm going to try to take one more try at this, and I'm sorry if we're making you repeat yourself. I know it would be a lot easier if you were able to do this accountant to accountant. So in this case, there is a $3 billion net built-in loss that comes at the point of acquisition.
Correct.
Is what you're saying that if the portfolio of loans further deteriorates beyond what had been built in, so there's a $3 billion built-in loss, but the actual losses accrued are $6 billion, you can take the $1 billion, which is a part of the built-in loss, and there's a three-year period, so the second and third billion still needs to wait, but then the additional loss can then also be taken in the first year?
Yes, essentially that's right, without getting technical, yes.
And how did the notice change, and my understanding, the notice actually changed the tax treatment of that additional, the additional three, the difference between three and the six, is that right?
No, actually, the notice did not. But what the notice really did was that $2 billion that would not be recognized in year one because, I call it the donut hole, maybe a bad term, but that $2 billion would now not be limited. Because if it was bad debt related, which is what the new bill is primarily about with Wachovia. Okay, so what the notice did was it said instead of you having to wait to get that second and third year to transpire and recognize and carry forward that amount,
mm-hmm.
it says that you do not apply 382H to bad debt losses.
I see. So in that case...
So it's really, we're talking, and that's been the confusion in the media, we're talking about this timing difference of recognizing something over 3 years or immediately. And so that's a really important point. So let me just stop and make sure you follow that.
So, yeah, I mean, it sounds like 2000, tell us if we're accurate on this, 2008-83 in the $3 billion example we're using would have allowed Wells to take the entire $3 billion in year one as opposed to $1 billion in years one, two, and three.
Correct. And that's why I said earlier it was really tax, doing an unassisted deal or an assisted deal with tax attributes that was more important than this notice, because you're talking about the time value of money, and remember, we're talking about $2 billion pre-tax, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's the deduction, but you only get a 35% of that as real cash. And I'm going to now confuse you a little more, but I think I need to do it. Our actual fact pattern for the year after merger, year one that we're talking about,
mm-hmm.
is that we had a consolidated loss.
And what year are we talking?
Because
I know the transaction closed on 12/31/08. So are we talking 08 or 09?
So the first year of a merged Wells Fargo Wachovia merged combined company was 2009. The company's tax results, not its financial statement, because again, of all these different tax accounting rules, produced a loss. A loss which then didn't even let us recognize any zero of that $3 billion. So we've been talking about, well, you can get $1 billion in year one, but if we didn't have the notice issued, right, it would be a third, a third, a third in our facts.
Mm-hmm.
Well, our facts actually, because of operation of separate tax law, didn't allow us to take any of the $3 billion in year one. Because we had a loss, so we just couldn't use that $1 billion. And in fact, it's really going to be close whether or not the year's not done now. So we're either going to get two-thirds of it, we're going to get, we'll either get it in year two, this is the current year, 2010, or it'll actually lap into year three. It's really on the cusp. I can't tell you where we're going to land because we don't know. So in a fluke, we get this notice that says, hey, ignore, and there's some good reasons for that notice, by the way, because you have to track loans at a loan-by-loan level to see if you have a build-in gain or loss each year. So very complex computation that Treasury was really just trying to administratively ease, so to provide certainty to acquirers. But with our fact pattern, the reality is, we didn't get any benefit in year one. We may get the benefit in year two. Let's say we do, right? So we get the benefit of $3 billion in year two versus a third, a third, a third, right? We're talking about an extra billion of deductions that would may, because we don't know if it will, get accelerated. That's 333 million tax affected. And then at today's Fed funds rate, you're talking about less than $1 million time value of money on this deduction. So it's very insignificant in the scheme of any of the economics, the notice to us. Right. It just seems to have gotten a life of its own as to the media or anyone's attention, given the facts that we know.
So you said one thing in there, that probably not surprisingly, I didn't follow. And that is, I thought when I repeated back that 2008-83 allowed Wells to take, if it had taxable income, of course, all $3 billion in year one rather than $1 billion a year over each of the next 3 years. That was an accurate statement, right?
Correct, yeah.
So then why? But then I thought when you were explaining how, in 2009 Wells couldn't take anything, because it didn't have taxable income, you then said, so now, maybe we'll be able to take two-thirds this year. Why can't you take the whole thing?
No, I'm sorry. Under old pre-notice rule, we would have been able to take two-thirds.
Okay.
Right?
Okay.
With the notice, we can take the whole thing.
Okay.
So, again, my example, let me be very clear. My example is, okay, let's assume best-case scenario, we get the whole $3 billion. Under old law, we would have had the right to take two-thirds of it, because that's 2 years.
Right.
And so all I'm doing is comparing two-thirds to 100%. There's a third of the $3 billion, $1 billion, that may, if we're lucky enough, get accelerated by virtue of the notice. That $1 billion tax affected is my $333 million. I'm just using a 33% tax rate. It's actually $350 million. All right? And I'm just applying a Fed funds rate for 1 year. And that's under $1 million of interest that we might make and the government forgoes.
Okay. I get that.
And you can quibble on the interest rate, too. But we're not, again, it's a magnitude that is very insignificant, the timing benefit. And all it did was provide us with timing assurance.
Right. So I know, and I don't have your 2009 annual report in front of me now, but I know I wrote this down earlier in the week. I believe there was a disclosure in there that said there was a $4.3 billion tax benefit related to the acquisition of Wachovia. Do you know what I'm talking about?
4.3?
Yeah.
It's not coming to my mind. Do you know where it might have been disclosed?
Yeah, I actually do. Let's see. And it's 2009 report. Wells disclosed $4.3 billion of unrecognized tax benefits in 2008 related to the Wachovia acquisition. Footnote. 2009 annual report at page 175. Yeah, and I think those are the notes to your consolidated.
Yeah. I'm looking at my. You're looking at the 09 annual report?
Yeah. And I'm just looking at what I wrote. I don't actually have the annual report in front of me.
Let me get there. 175?
At 175, yeah. According, unless I wrote it wrong in my footnote.
Chris, were you saying it's in those numbers come from the footnote?
No.
I'm saying my footnote to my writing, but I'm talking what I'm referencing. All I'm saying is I say there's $4.3 billion. I got that number from page 175 of your 09 annual report.
I am looking at page 175 right now. Bear with me, Chris.
And there's some tables in there for taxes, and I think it's the tax note to the audited financials, isn't it?
I'm seeing 4.9. You're saying 4.5?
It may have been in the narrative. I said 4.3, but I could have fat-fingered the keyboard. But anyway, it was more than $3 billion. And I never saw anything else in the annual report for any additional explanation for what that $4.3 billion was, although as I think I told Rob in an email, you know, I didn't peruse through every page of your annual report, so I certainly could have missed it.
Okay, I am, first of all, the $3 billion is the amount of limitation, and Your page 175 is our income tax footnote, part of the note, and it has a table talking about unrecognized tax benefits and changes.
Yeah, that's probably it.
Okay, and it ends the year with a unrecognized tax benefit of 4.9, and it began the year at 7.5. And there's here's what you're probably, I see it now. There's a $4.3 billion number in 2008, 12/31/2008, which would have included Wachovia, and it says for tax positions from business combinations. Right? And it says unrecognized tax benefit from the Wachovia acquisition. Okay? So I see what you're talking about.
Okay.
Now that is unrelated to this new bill or Section 382. What that is a reserve, because what you're talking about is Unrecognized tax benefit is positions that you have that are in dispute with tax authorities, or that you don't have a comfort level to have recognized them for accounting purposes. So now you're actually, you've kind of switched into an area of accounting and tax that's completely different from what we've been talking about, but I'd be happy to walk you through it. What that really represented was some disputes that Wachovia was having with the IRS, actually related to what are called LILO transactions, lease in, lease out, which is a coordinated IRS tax issue. Primarily that, I think it's all that actually, but you know, I'm talking contemporaneously.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened was we resolved those issues with the IRS during 2009, and so in essence, this reserve, because it was not recognized, so it's out there as a liability, and that's why it's required under the accounting rules to be disclosed, was utilized to resolve that conflict. So it's got nothing to do with the 382 discussion or the notice. It's really unrecognized benefits because they had a part of their tax attributes, again, because when you do a unassisted deal, you get, not only do you get these attributes that might be favorable, you get the unfavorable because we are now on the hook with all the tax authorities because, you know, we inherited all that tax liability, one of which was this controversy, which there was established at 1231-2008, unrecognized liability reserve. I'll just call it what it is, a tax reserve. That reserve was utilized in the dispute resolution settlement with the Internal Revenue Service. Does
okay.
that make sense?
It makes sense enough.
Okay.
Just to make sure I get it too, 2008, even though the Wachovia transaction closes, there's no benefits or the consolidated financials of Wells Fargo as of 12/31/08 does or does not include Wachovia.
12/31/08 balance sheet included Wachovia and included all of our required purchase accounting. Yes, the 12/31/08 income statement does not include Wachovia because we closed the deal on December 31st, so there was no period of income.
Right, right.
We did make what we called a conforming loan loss allowance adjustment to conform the Wells Fargo reserving methodology, but now I'm going into kind of a different issue. But fundamentally, the balance sheet is combined and the income statement stands apart because their results, they didn't have any results because they didn't have any operational activity because we closed after the close of business on the 31st.
All right, that makes sense. Okay, so I guess Wachovia may have actually had a income statement filing for 08.
They had a separate tax return for 08.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And then, as you said, again, just make sure I'm clear, in 09, obviously that is a consolidated income statement, but no, at least new bill tax benefits are recognized by Wells in 09 because Wells had a loss, not any pre-tax income.
That's correct. In fact, in that very same note, Chris, you will see the components of income tax expense. You'll see that the what's called current, there's current and deferred, and I don't want to go into tax accounting, but current is what you currently anticipate to pay to the government, to the tax authorities, and we had a loss of $4 billion, a negative current tax expense, which meant we had a loss, and we had no benefit from the new bill related matter.
Okay.
Of that. And again, it just happens to be our facts.
But when I look at your 2009 income statement, Don't I see pre-tax income of $17.9 billion and a $5.3 billion tax expense?
That's correct. That's correct. And that gets into tax accounting. Now, you know, again, not tax return. Now we're talking GAAP, generally accepted accounting principle, accounting. And so remember, for tax purposes, one has to wait until the charge-off event to take a deduction, to take a current tax benefit. For accounting purposes, we had done purchase accounting. So if you want to think about it this way, there were reserves or write-downs that were taken for book purposes that were not recognizable for tax purposes. So as I told you, there's a $4.1 billion current tax benefit, like a refund, if you want to call it a negative, but that's offset by a $9.4 billion deferred tax expense. So we have already, for book purposes, recognized losses on much of the portfolio that were never recognized for tax. And so what we're doing, that deferred tax expense, is the proper accounting for that pre-tax book income, because we will, on that income, have to pay taxes on it. But the timing of when we pay that taxes is different than the tax return recognition, and the book recognition is different, and that's where you get into this current and deferred. When you combine it together, current and deferred creates the total. The total is the 5.3, because we know that we will have to recognize that taxable, that tax amount, when that income is ultimately reflected in the tax return. In fact, it is, most of it's reflected in the tax return for 09, but there were reversing differences in the deferred area, and I know I'm losing it, so I'll just stop there.
All right, so, and thank you, because you were. So when you said that Wells didn't have pre-tax income, you meant the tax books, not the GAAP books.
Correct, thank you. Very important clarification. I'm talking, when I was talking about getting the benefit, I'm talking about the income tax return, the federal income tax return, and actual cash kind of payments going to and from the U.S. Treasury due to that tax return filing, not for the financial statement GAAP accounting.
Okay.
Very important clarification. Thank you.
Okay. And then I think, just to close it out, unless some of my colleagues have questions, and I know I'm repeating myself, so I apologize. $3 billion new bill from the Wachovia acquisition. Nothing recognized in 2008 because there was no income from the combined entity in 2008. Nothing recognized in 2009 because there's no pre-tax income on the tax books in 2009. Maybe you'll recognize something this year because you may have pre-tax income on your tax books in 2010. Regardless, given 2008-83, you could recognize as much as $3 billion in tax benefits if you have that much pre-tax income, but whenever you'll recognize it as soon as you have pre-tax income on your tax books going forward. Is that generally accurate?
That is accurate, and the only difference is that notice kind of will let us recognize it as soon as we have pre-tax income, and we don't have to worry about timing.
Okay, so now let me ask something else. Are there other tax benefits from the Wachovia merger other than this $3 billion nubble we've been talking about?
Well, I would call them tax attributes, Chris. Okay. Because there are, you know, the tax attributes associated with Wachovia are really what survived doing an unassisted deal. And those tax attributes are more than the $3 billion, right? Mm-hmm. The $3 billion is a subset of the total.
And what I really mean are tax attributes that, you know, like the new bills we've been talking about, that I guess wouldn't have been there in an assisted acquisition. If they would have been there in an assisted acquisition, I don't think I'm so interested in it.
Yeah. Again, that, now you're coming back to the kind of the macro question that we focused on that. Subsequent to the weekend, Those tax attributes are all of those timing differences between when a company recognizes something for book purposes but has not yet for tax. So yes, if you, I think we shared with you our model that we shared with the board when we went to the board for approval to make an offer.
Okay.
Okay.
And I think we have that handy here. Is this the...
we called the Wachovia Project Wiley.
Yes,
I don't know.
I have Project Wiley, October 2nd, 2008.
Exactly. Right. Page number, if you would go to page number 9 of the deck, 9 of 32.
I'm there.
Okay. What we were doing is, I think the best way of saying what are the total tax attributes at the time of the definitive agreement, that would be, if you go down about three quarters of the page, there's a line item in the asset section, right, a few lines above the after-tax intangible, called deferred taxes. Do you see that line?
Yeah, I do.
Okay. The $6.751 billion. All the way to the right?
Yeah, hold on. My print is small. I got to make sure I'm on the right line. Yeah, he's got the 6.751. Okay.
All right. That's probably your best proxy for what the tax attributes are in total, inclusive of that $3 billion, because that's in total. And, you know, the $3 billion gets to be recognized because it would have been realized, irrespective of the notice, it would have been realized. It's just a matter of time. So it's inclusive in there.
Okay.
So, what's that's your best proxy, along with that $6.7 billion, because that's the book tax difference. That's what a deferred tax asset is. Kind of comes back to that prior confusing discussion I led you through.
Mm-hmm.
But what the deferred tax item is it's trying to say what is being recognized for book that has not yet been recognized for tax. That's deferred tax accounting under FAS 109.
Okay, and
so
again,
this is really the proxy of, hey, here at this measurement date, looking at this balance sheet, and of course, you know, this keeps moving because the book tax differences are always moving. But using this point in time, it was $6.7 billion.
And again, we've already talked about how the $3 billion Newble, you know, would not have been available to Wells in an assisted deal. Is the $3.751 billion the same? Wouldn't have been available in an assisted deal?
Yeah, this whole $6.7 billion would have been wiped out in an assisted deal. And so now I think you can see why the economics between doing an unassisted deal and an assisted deal makes sense. And in fact, it's this benefit, if I can call it that, these attributes that were the focus of our continued analysis, in addition to, obviously, the more important thing, because tax is a subset. The reality is it was the credit and getting our arms around and comfortable around the credit. So these two things were the primary driver behind making an unassisted offer after the assisted transaction was announced.
Right, and if I wanted to do a very rough proxy for the amount of money that Wells didn't pay in taxes, would I take 35% of that $6.7 billion number?
Well, first of all, this is a tax-affected number.
Okay. I don't.
So this really is like, you know, this is, you'd have to divide it by 35%, so you're really talking about a gross up of, on a pre-tax basis. So you need to kind of line yourself up. And no, I don't think that would be a fair analysis, because we also are including the income from Wachovia in in our ongoing filings. And that's very significant, because you can see that on our financial statements, which already have recognized the losses, because we, in essence, had to reserve for them or account for them under GAAP accounting. And so these benefits, if you want to call these attributes benefits, have to be measured against the offsetting earnings stream, which is very significant when you take out what we like to call de-risk the loan portfolio.
Okay.
And but in fact, even if Wachovia, let's look at it this way, Wachovia had not gone through any transaction and was standalone. Let's say they got TARP funding or whatever, however, it would have been the same thing. They would have had these tax attributes irrespective of the transaction. They would have continued, and they would have had their earnings unrelated to bad debt deductions continuing to offset those deductions and paying the tax above and beyond that. So I don't think you can do the math that you were suggesting, would be my view.
Okay, but you would have, in an assisted deal, you would have been recognizing Wachovia income too, right?
That's correct.
I mean, okay, yeah. I mean, all I'm trying to get at, and frankly, the last thing you said is what really struck me, is that assuming no, you know, I mean, I'm sure your folks have told you. I mean, what I'm at least trying to figure out is, you know, how much money didn't go to the Treasury, you know, because of this. And so I'm just trying to figure the effective tax rate. But it certainly makes a difference, at least in my mind, on this kind of notice that, well, yeah, look, I mean, just understanding you don't agree with the 35% number, let's just do it even easier. Let's just say $2 billion. All right, so $2 billion doesn't go to the Treasury over however many years, you know, as you recognize this. But as you said, if this deal never would have gone down, and if there also wouldn't have been any assisted deal by anybody, Wachovia wouldn't have paid the same money to the Treasury either, right?
That's right. We and Wachovia are really equal, right? If they had stayed independent, they would have had these attributes. We had the attributes. They would have had the income. We have the income. I think I understand what you're asking. Let me make sure you're really saying if it was assisted, you would have wiped out these attributes, and therefore, if you look at a holistic view, maybe it's more costly to the government to keep these attributes, to have kept these attributes alive. But is that? I think that's your premise, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's essentially this. I mean, say that, for example, that the Citi deal, while there was a loss sharing arrangement with the government, the government actually, you know, they got lucky, right? And there actually weren't losses beyond the $42 billion or whatever it was. I think that's what the deal was. Citi would cover the first 42 over 3 years, and the government would take a percentage, you know, after that on like a $300 billion portfolio. But let's just assume that there weren't more than $42 billion of losses, and the government didn't have to shell out one penny on that quote unquote assisted deal.
Okay.
But then, and compare it to this. Well, on this deal, there's at least some amount of money that's not going to the Treasury. That in trying to compare the Citi quote unquote assisted deal to the Wells Fargo quote unquote unassisted deal, looking at it on not just an FDIC assistance, but on a total government basis, you know, which one costs the government more?
That's right. I think I understand what you're saying. Mm-hmm. I think it's a little bit crystal ball because, you know, how much are the losses? And if it was less than $46 billion, I think, you know, there's merit. I might want to make one counterpoint, though.
Sure.
And that is the assisted transaction left things dangling that definitely would have cost the Treasury something. You would have left the holding company and all its investors and bondholders would have had most likely, again, just as you are, kind of a speculation, but you would have had losses there that I think you have to kind of factor in some fashion. You would have had the kind of the Wachovia securities entity, which would have not been viable. I don't know what would have happened and how that would have played out. So there was kind of there was a mess in the transaction contemplated as structured, which was avoided by virtue of the fact that we merged with all of, and acquired all of Wachovia, not pieces of Wachovia. But otherwise, I understand your premise and your logic.
Okay. All right. My head hurts, but I appreciate the information. I can guarantee you I'm not going to go get an LLM in tax. But I really do appreciate the information. Rob, I'll talk to you later on today or tomorrow or something. And, you know, I'm sure you've told folks everything. But we'll look at our notes. We'll talk amongst ourselves. If I have any follow-up questions, Rob, I'll just give you a ring.
Okay, great.
Actually, hold on. Don't go away. One quick follow-up.
I don't want to get everything more confused here, but I just want to be clear about one thing. You said that there are the marginal savings with 2008-83, but that also the benefits of the tax attributes, it's an ongoing process, and it's difficult to quantify the loan losses. Is it possible that the savings under 2008-83 could be greater than expected if the loan losses, when you quantify the loan losses, if they're larger than you think?
No, actually, if anything, it would cut the other way. If we continue to not be able to absorb some of that deduction, right, it would just delay. So instead of, you know, I gave you the best case scenario, but let's say we're not profitable from a tax perspective in 2010, and hypothetically, and our projections aren't really going there, but let's say, and 11, right, we would have no benefit from the, in fact, we had, you know, we got no benefit from the notice. Because it's really just an ability to recognize it earlier if you have the income without worrying about the timing.
So there is no kind of, I remember from way back in the day, from when I was a bank examiner, there was this like this FAS 38 provision in GAAP that said after you do an acquisition, you've got like a year to actually increase the goodwill if you find additional losses. There's nothing like that for this $3 billion number that lets you guys increase it if you find stuff during a certain period of time after the acquisition closes?
No, there's no look back. The only thing is, you know, we've been talking about the $3 billion because it's what we put in the S-4. It's substantially the same. The only thing that would change would be what were the numbers at closing, because that would be based on our closing price, et cetera, et cetera. And it did not move significantly. So, you know, using the $3 billion was fine. But that would be the only thing that would have changed versus the numbers that we have. There's no look back. It was only, okay, what was the actual computation at that point in time?
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen, for your time. Rob will be in touch.
Okay, thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.